I'm Christopher Lighton with the writer Kai Bird, whose stock in trade is the apocalypse in various forms. He's written a great deal about nuclear weapons and the men like J. Robert Oppenheimer who made them. Also, the Bundy brothers, McGeorge and William, who had a hand in managing them. Now, Kai Bird has written about the political fault line in Jerusalem, the very neighborhood where Kai Bird grew up in the 1950s and 60s, where a lot of people have fantasized the final shootout on Earth. The place where Kai Bird has always felt the lively chance of another way. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Kai Bird, I read your book, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, as memoir and history, but most of all, as might have beens in the long Arab-Israeli conflict, and might even still be's. How directly can we get from your own lifetime in the Middle East to a view through the impasses today? Occupation, settlements, Palestinian housing, statehood, rights of return, that sort of thing. All those roads not taken that might yet be fruitful.
It is both memoir and history. And it's called Crossing Mandelbaum Gate because when I was taken to Jerusalem at the age of 4, I lived in Arab East Jerusalem, but I went to school in the Jewish West Jerusalem. And I crossed every day through Mandelbaum Gate, which was the one checkpoint, a very grim, bleak-looking gate in which there were tank barriers and barbed wire and first Jordanian soldiers and then Israeli soldiers at the second checkpoint. And this was literally my earliest childhood memory.
Those times can sound quaint, but were you scared?
I was very aware, even as a young boy, of the conflict, of the borders. I remember one day going through the checkpoint, and we got through the Jordanian first gate, and we were approaching the Israeli checkpoint, and suddenly I cried out to my father, "Daddy, Daddy, stop the car!" And he turned around in astonishment and looked at me, and I was groping at my T-shirt, trying to take off a button with an image of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, the Arab nationalist leader who was wildly popular in East Jerusalem and was considered an enemy of the Israelis. And of course, I, in my childhood naivete, I thought that the Israeli soldiers were going to take offense and see me as a target. So I was, you know, very keenly aware of the conflict. But I wrote this book. This book has been sort of eating at me for 20 years. I had, as a young journalist in the 70s and 80s, I really tried to avoid writing about the Middle East. It was such an emotional black hole and so controversial. But then the Persian Gulf War happened in 1991, and that war brought back a rush of childhood memories. And I sat down and I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post about living in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, about my childhood friend who happened to be half Jewish. His mother was a German Jew who'd come to Palestine in the 30s, and his father was a Muslim Palestinian. So he had a foot in each community. And I wrote about what a kinder and gentler place the Arab world was then, and Jerusalem in particular. But then I wrote also about the fact that as a young man, I happened to fall in love and marry my wife, Susan, who is not only Jewish, but she's the only daughter of two Holocaust survivors. And coming to know her, I came to understand, you know, the enormity of that calamity and how we're still living with it today.
Yeah, the presence of
so it was sort of, in my marriage has been another crossing of Mandelbaum Gate, another opportunity to see both sides of this terrible conflict.
You're fascinated by all the missed opportunities on every side. What do they tell you about the opportunities still today?
Well, there have been many roads not taken. You know, there were opportunities actually under Gamal Abdel Nasser's period in the 50s when there were secret negotiations between the Israelis and the Egyptians that never went anywhere. There was, you know, the wars that should not have happened, including, I would argue, the June 1967 war, which was regarded at the time as a great victory for Israel, but actually has become, had planted the seeds of the disaster we're now facing. The occupation of the settlements in the West Bank, and the stalemate that we're at. But there, you know, I would argue that there is hope. There are reasonable people on both sides. Unfortunately, the situation has been hijacked by the extremists, who are increasingly religious and messianic, and that's where we're at. It's unfortunately.
What were the big loss chances?
Well, there are many, but for instance, when I was growing up as a child in the Arab world, every young Arab man wanted, desired to be modern in a Western sense and to be secular. And the great leader of the Arab world at the time, the most popular man elected duly president in Egypt, was Gamal Abdel Nasser. But Nasser was ultimately defeated not only by the Israelis in 1967 in the June war, but essentially by we Americans, too, who regarded him, our policymakers, regarded him as a dangerous neutral in the Cold War who was flirting with the Soviets. But when Nasser was defeated in 1967, that dealt a death blow to the Arab nationalist secular worldview. And that opened the window eventually to the Islamic fundamentalists who are now, you know, have the momentum. Now, that was one missed opportunity. But on the Israeli side, I would argue that the conflict has prolonged, has been with us now for more than 60 years, in part because of questions of identity, of questions in Israel of how to define the new Israeli state, how to define who is an Israeli citizen and who is a Jew. And I learned this very graphically when I first met a Israeli patriot named Hillel Cook.
Yes.
And Cook...
I've never heard of Hillel Cook.
He's largely forgotten, but he's a fascinating man who led an incredible life. At the age of 16, he joined the Irgun, the underground Israeli militia group that fought for independence. But he was sent as a young man to New York in 1940 as the Irgun's undercover emissary to America to raise money for guns and to help Jews to immigrate to Palestine. But in 1942, he was sitting at his morning breakfast reading the newspaper, and I'm buried in page 19 on the New York in the New York Times was a story, very detailed, very credible, about mobile killing squads going around executing Jews in Eastern Europe. And these reports were confirmed by the State Department, according to the Times. Bergson, Hillel Cook was his Israeli name, Hebrew name, but in America he had undertaken an alias because he was a member of an illegal organization, the Irgun. He took on the anglicized name of Peter Bergson, so he was known in America as Peter Bergson. And Bergson that day decided that he had a new mission, and he called his Irgun colleagues together that evening and said, "We have a new agenda. It's now to rescue Jews from anywhere in occupied Europe, Nazi Europe, and bring them to any safe haven." And in his mind, the biggest problem to rescue was the United States and the policy of the Roosevelt administration, which was keeping the lid on immigration quotas and wasn't publicizing the very fact of what was happening, the Holocaust. So he took out huge full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post. People forget this, but they were very provocative ads, reading, "Jews for sale, $50 a head." And then in small print, he would explain that the Romanian Nazi government on the fringes of the Nazi Empire was willing to trade 10,000 Jews for some gold bullion and trucks. Just extraordinary. Bergson was into lobbying Congress and lobbying the American people. He got Ben Hecht, the famous film script writer, to write a pageant that was put on in Madison Square Garden to announce that European Jewry were being decimated. And 40,000 Americans went into Madison Square Garden and saw this pageant. It went on the road. Eleanor Roosevelt wrote about it. You know, he was really putting pressure on the Roosevelt administration to do something, to act to save Jews. And eventually he succeeded in a year. In January 1944, he got the Roosevelt administration to form the War Refugee Board, which sent Raoul Wallenberg to Budapest, where he saved 20,000 Hungarian Jews. The War Refugee Board began bribing Nazi guards in Spain and Romania and Bulgaria. They traded Jews for gold, as Cook had promised in his New York Times ads. Eventually, most historians now think that the War Refugee Board saved 200,000 lives.
And yet he's not a popular figure, not a hero anymore. There was a turn in his life, and it's important. Tell that story.
Well, after living for 5 years in America, in New York and Washington, lobbying to rescue European Jewry, he also realized that, in conversations with people like Henry Morgenthau, that Jewish Americans were not ever going to be leaving America and immigrate to Palestine. They were Americans of Jewish ancestry, but they were very much Americans. And so in his mind, he realized that the new state, he considered himself to be a Hebrew Palestinian or Jewish Palestinian, the new state of Israel should become a haven for those remnants of European Jewry who had survived the Holocaust, and for the Jews who were already living in British-occupied Palestine. So his vision, though, was, even though he was a member of the Irgun and working with Menachem Begin at that time, his vision was to create a Hebrew Republic. So he started a Committee for the National Liberation of the Hebrew People of Palestine, and called himself ambassador and set up an embassy in Washington. And then he left to go to Israel, the newly created state, in 1948, and he ran for the first constituent assembly. But his argument was that the new state should be secular, very much a division between synagogue and state, and that this would open the door to an inclusive society, inclusive of non-Jews, Christians, or Muslims who also were in the state, but that it would be a state that was imbued, drenched in Jewish culture as such, but the state's identity would be based on its language, Hebrew. And as such, that would be the state of Israel would become a state like any other state. It would be, the Hebrews of Israel would be Hebrews just like the Frenchmen are Frenchmen in France. It would be a modern 20th century secular state. Well, this was very controversial. It was opposed by Ben-Gurion and by Menachem Begin, and Cook split with them. He became a very provocative figure in the early years of the 1950s. And eventually he was politically defeated and left Israel.
It's so fascinating, Kai Bird. This notion of a Hebrew Republic, so-called, came up with me in conversation with Mustafa Barghouti the other day, the Palestinian activist. It's also the title of a book by Bernard Avishai. This vision, as I was saying to Barghouti, just what you said, a nation that is Jewish the way France is French, but not exclusively and not religiously, not theocratically. Why is it so controversial, and what hope does it hold out, as you see it, for the world today?
Well, if Israel becomes a Hebrew Republic, and I would argue, as does Bernard Avishai in his brilliant book, The Hebrew Republic, it is going in that direction. Most Israelis are very much secular. Most Israelis live along the Mediterranean coast in Tel Aviv, and they're highly educated, inventive, cosmopolitan, high-tech, and productive members of their society, but they're secular, and yet they're drenched in Jewish culture and in the Hebrew language. And if Israel becomes more of a Hebrew Republic and less of a Jewish state as such, that opens the door to becoming good neighbors with their own Arab citizens, Israeli citizens, the Arab Israelis, but also with their neighbors in the West Bank and Egyptians and Syrians. It becomes less of a religious conflict and more of a question of where the border is going to be between these states.
How far is that idea from Bibi Netanyahu's agenda or the conversations eternally ongoing between the United States and the Israeli government?
Well, what I'm speaking of is very controversial and provocative, and yet, ironically, Bibi Netanyahu comes from, you know, the Likud, which comes from Menachem Begin's party, which comes from Zev Jabotinsky, the great revisionist leader, who Hillel Cook was an aide to. And ironically, Jabotinsky and the radical revisionists of the 1930s and 40s envisioned a secular republic. They did not talk about a Jewish state. They talked about a state where Jews could not be Jews if they chose, where they would be normal, where they would no longer be categorized as a minority, and they would simply be modern human beings filled with multiple identities, not simply a religious label, one identity that stigmatizes them. So there is a deep tradition to, even in Netanyahu's own party, to what I'm speaking about, a secular Hebrew republic. But it's today, we've been going for 60 years in the other direction, precisely because the conflict has been prolonged, because Israelis are drenched in a sense of victimhood, not only from the Holocaust, but now from all the wars and the suicide bombers. And they face an enemy, the Palestinians, who also are drenched in victimhood and see themselves as the victims of the 60-year conflict. So it's a terrible tragedy. But this sense that this notion that a secular Hebrew Republic as such, a more secular Israel, will evolve over the next 20, 30 years of globalization, is a hope, I would argue, that this conflict can eventually be resolved.
You lived in Egypt, too, in the 1960s. What did you see of the change in Egypt's direction?
Well, in the 60s, Egypt was led by this highly popular Arab nationalist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who slowly became, you know, an autocrat, a dictator, but he was still wildly popular. And in Cairo, I happened to live in a district called Mahdi, a suburb south of the city that had actually been developed by several Jewish-Egyptian entrepreneurs at the turn of the century. And in the 50s, it was still nearly 50% of the Mahdi residents were Jewish Egyptians. Mm. It was a very cosmopolitan place, which made Egypt still a very cosmopolitan place. Mm. But, you know, gradually, because of the creation of Israel in 48 and then the 56 war, many of those Jewish Egyptians eventually left, discouraged, fearful. And so Egypt was becoming a less cosmopolitan place, which is a tragedy, of course. But ironically, in Mahdi, when I was there in the 2 years leading up to the June 67 war, one of my neighbors was a man my age, who we now know as Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, the number two of al-Qaeda.
Right.
He was a teenager. He went to the same Mahdi Sporting Club that I did to see Hollywood movies on an outdoor screen. I'm sure we passed each other every day on bicycles in Mahdi. And Zawahiri was, the product of Nasser's Egypt. He was the son of a doctor. He aspired to become a medical doctor, which he did eventually. But after the 67 war, you know, where the idea of a secular Arab progressive state was utterly defeated and humiliated. Mm. Zawahiri went off track. He was outraged. He was humiliated as an Arab, as a young man. He became increasingly radicalized in a religious sense. And by the 70s, he was essentially a right-wing member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he then, his trajectory, as we know, went off the deep end and led eventually to 9/11. But this is, you know, another road not taken in the Arab world. And I would argue that, you know, there is hope. I don't believe that the Arab world is going to be forever enthralled with Islamic fascism as such. In fact, I quote Dr. Sadiq al-Azam, the great Syrian philosopher, Yale-trained, who argues that 9/11 was actually the high point of this Islamic political movement, and they have no real answers. They can't provide real economic answers and reforms and products to the Arab world. And eventually we're going to get back on the secular track, but it needn't have gone this direction, I would argue.
And what of Saudi Arabia meantime?
Well, I lived in Saudi Arabia in 1962 to 65, and it was a very surreal place then. It was jumping from the 17th century into the 20th century in a sense of economic modernization. But one of the reasons I wrote this book was to try to figure out, as an historian, what was actually happening historically and politically when I was a child that I was unaware of because I was too young. Well, I got into the archives and into the history books, and I discovered that when I was in Arabia in those early years of the 60s, there was a slow-moving coup d'etat taking place, a power struggle within the House of Saud between the Crown Prince Faisal and his elder brother, King Saud. And ironically enough, King Saud had allied himself with some young radical red princes, as they called themselves, or other people called them, who had been educated abroad in England and America and came back to Arabia with notions of democracy and a free press. And they became top aides to the king and started talking about holding elections and how they were going to write a constitution and turn Arabia into a constitutional monarchy. And they allied themselves to some commoners who had been educated but they also talked about how the oil concession agreement dating back to the late 1930s was really not very fair, and they wanted to reform that concession. Uh-oh. Well, this was very threatening to Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, and so Aramco allied itself with the CIA and with the U.S. government and put its weight and power and influence behind Crown Prince Faisal. And by late 1964, King Saud was dethroned. Faisal became king. And King Faisal was an economic modernizer, but he was an extreme political conservative. And one of the things he did, alas, was he put the ulama, the Wahhabi priests, on government salary. Mm. He gave them money to become missionaries, to export Wahhabi ideas to the other parts of the Arab world and as far away as India. And this, of course, planted the seeds of a new sort of political radical Islamic movement that has come back to bite us. So Faisal, I argue, was another missed opportunity. But the good news is that I think after nearly 40 years later, Arabia is headed inevitably in this age of globalization to a new liberal era. The current king, Abdullah, is regarded as a liberal. He's been very critical of the ulema, the priesthood, and he's trying to disempower them, and he's building universities, he's investing in education. And I could see in the next decade, perhaps we'll find Arabia undergoing a process towards which it becomes a constitutional monarchy. And that will be a big change, and it will influence the rest of the Arab world. And I would hope, in particular, Egypt, where, alas, we have had nearly 30 years of a military dictatorship buttressed by billions of American dollars every year, which I think has been madness and has helped to empower the religious messianic elements who out of frustration, turned to religion because there's no reform, there's no open press, there's no secular option.
On both sides, though, you're saying, Kai Bird, the secularists in the Arab world and in Israel have been pushed aside, especially among the younger generations, by a kind of different sorts of religious fervor. How far are the parties today, including the American negotiators, from an explicitly democratic and secular formula that could find the path again?
Well, I think there is hope. We're at a stalemate. We're at loggerheads now. But anyone who looks at this issue understands what eventually is going to happen, what should happen.
People always say that, and I wonder, well, why doesn't it?
Well, I end my book with a description of going back and revisiting my old childhood neighbor, Sari Nusseibeh, in East Jerusalem. Sari is now the president of Al-Quds University. And I tell the story of how in about 2003, he heard a knock at his door, and he opened the door, and there was the former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence agency, Ami Ayalon. And Ayalon held up one page document with 7 points written on it, and he said, "Sari, I've come up with a peace plan. Will you sign it?" And Sari looked at it, and he actually studied it for a few months and changed a few words and put his name to it. And now 250,000 Israelis have signed this citizens' initiative, and a slightly fewer number of Palestinians. It's a very simple plan. It says two states for two peoples. The borders should be basically the Green Line of 1967, with an exchange of land to take into consequence the practicalities of who's built what settlements where, to have a rational border. And then Jerusalem would be a shared capital of both Israel and the new Palestinian state. And also the plan takes into account that there should be compensation given to the Palestinian refugees who were expelled or walked out of Palestine during 1948.
What does compensation mean?
Well, meaning money, I think. And this fund would be contributed to by the international community, but also very specifically by Israel. And this is an important point because the Palestinians need an acknowledgement of their victimhood, that Israel played a role in what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the great disaster, and that they are in part responsible for what happened to the Palestinian refugees. Now, the Nusseibeh-Ayalon plan does not include a provision for refugee return to Israel. So the notion that there must be some kind of acknowledgement or even apology for what happened to the Palestinian refugees by way of giving them compensation from a fund contributed to by Israel is very essential and important, and it is part of the Nusseibeh-Ayalon plan.
We hear this continuously, that people know what the final resolution is. It's in a drawer someplace, and it's always there, if we really need it or decide that we have the courage to apply it. What is holding it up?
Well, at the moment, what's holding it up is that there's the extremists on both sides. On the Palestinian side, the extremists, meaning Hamas, and who feel that they've never gotten anywhere in negotiations, that the settlement projects continue to be built on occupied land in the West Bank. So Hamas won the last election, and so they, they're religious, messianic individuals led by men who think that over time they can, in the end, achieve a full recovery of the whole of Palestine. And so I call this, messianic. But I also look at what has happened over the last, particularly the last 40 years since the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, the same thing has happened in Israel. The politics has been led by increasingly religious, messianic politicians who think that if we just hold on to the status quo, maybe we can really occupy the whole of the West Bank and expand Israel's borders permanently and create facts on the ground. And these new facts on the ground are, you know, it's insanity. Because today the demographics are, you know, forcing us towards a complete, we're going to run over the precipice.
Kai Bird, we seem to be stuck between this impasse personified by Netanyahu and Obama and some sort of third way lurking by general agreement offstage. Who's going to reach for the third way?
Well, I hope, my hope is that people on the ground will. And we're seeing every Friday now in East Jerusalem, in my old childhood neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians coming together peacefully in a nonviolent fashion to protest the seizing of Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah and the demolition of some of those homes deemed illegal by Israeli authorities. So people coming together to protest this. And simultaneously, the Obama administration has laid down the gauntlet and said to the Netanyahu government that not only must there be a settlement freeze in the West Bank, but there must be a settlement freeze in East Jerusalem. Because if they continue to build in East Jerusalem, that's going to close the opportunity, any opportunity for East Jerusalem to become the capital of a Palestinian state. And that makes it impossible to have a two-state solution. So Obama is on the right track. And he has people, reasonable, nonviolent citizens of Israel and Palestine, trying to protest what's going on in East Jerusalem. And this is, I find this to be a great moment, a moment of hope. And Obama, if he can just stick to his guns as such and demand that the Israelis stop the settlements, this will empower actually the Palestinian Authority negotiators, give them the political credibility they need to begin face-to-face talks again. And I would argue Obama should actually take this Nusseibeh-Ayalon plan seriously. Hundreds of thousands of people have signed it. And he should go to Bibi Netanyahu and to the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas and company, and say, let's have a referendum. Let's just put this to a vote. Vote a referendum inside Israel, another referendum inside the Palestine Authority areas. And let's see if the people can go for this. And if I'm quite confident that most Israelis would vote for this seven-point plan. And if they did, that would box in the politicians. They could no longer say no to a two-state solution. And the way would be clear.
Fascinating. And it would stave off that apocalypse for a little while, the apocalypse that's threaded all through your work and your life. Thank you for your work. Thank you for crossing Mandelbaum Gate. Thank you for walking us through it.
Thank you, Chris. It was terrific talking to you.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.